You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're taking a visit now to Chinatown, to a quiet street on a hill. In the distance, across the 101, the twisted silver tops of Walt Disney Concert Hall. In the middle of the block, there's this huge, boxy apartment complex called Hillside Villa. It's light green, red trim. Through the front doors and out the back of the lobby in a shady courtyard, Renee Alexander sits drinking a cup of coffee.
This is not like it's not an ordinary building where people come and they move into their apartment and they stay to themselves and they don't know who their neighbors are. We are a community. We're a family. We've watched our kids grow up together. We watched them go from elementary to middle school to high school for the past 30 years.
And it was over those 30 years that the building was under a special contract that kept the rents low. But then, last year, that deal was set to expire, and tenants like Alexander faced big increases, or in some cases, evictions. Last week, however, LA's City Council approved a last-minute deal to keep the property affordable for another 10 years. And KCRW reporter Anna Scott was at the City Council meeting. She's here with me now to explain what happened and how it could affect tens of thousands of other renters in the city as well. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Affordable housing covenants, right? It's like a special kind of contract.
Yes, that is what we're talking about here. So this building, Hillside Villa, is one of many apartment buildings in Los Angeles in this same situation. It was built back in the 80s. And back in those days, California had something called community redevelopment agencies, including here in LA. They were public agencies that brought investment to poor neighborhoods. And one way that they did that was by increasing affordable housing. They lent money to developers. They would do low interest loans in exchange for keeping the rents below market rate for some number of decades. So 30 years was a pretty typical timeline, maybe 30 years, maybe 50 years in some cases. And now we're seeing a lot of those deals are coming up on their expiration dates, including Hillside Villa. This is coming at a time when we, as you know, are dealing with a huge homelessness crisis, a lack of affordable housing. So there's a lot of concern over these expiring covenants. The city right now is looking at more than 11,000 apartments with expiring covenants over the next year and a half. One of the people I spoke with was the city councilman who represents Chinatown, Gil Cedillo.
It's huge. It's a tsunami, and it'll be a setback for all our efforts to build affordable housing in the city. So we are deeply concerned.
They're concerned because he said it would be a setback for all the efforts to build affordable housing in the city. That's how many apartments could be looking at losing their affordable covenants in the coming years. So many that it could almost erase all the new affordable housing that they're trying to build.
Looking at Hillside Villa, Anna, the city was able to extend the covenant, right?
Right.
And how did they do it? And could they do the same thing to other buildings? Do they have to go building by building?
They are going building by building, at least for now. What happened at Hillside Villa is last year, the landlord there, a guy named Thomas Botts, gave notice that these covenants were expiring, and people panicked. For Renee Alexander, who you heard earlier, he lives with his mother, his sister, two nieces, and his husband, and they were looking at an increase of more than $700 a month. They pay around $1,200 now, so their rent was going to go up to more than $2,000 a month, which they just couldn't afford. For others in the building, they were looking at even more dramatic increases or even evictions. People got really scared. And there's a lot of people that live there. It's 124 apartments at Hillside Villa. Here's Alexander again.
A lot of these people are only paying $700, $800 for their units because they're seniors or disabled or very low income. But all of a sudden, they're having their rents jumped up, you know, $1,300, $1,400, more than what they were paying. And it was sheer panic.
So tenants did something that we see more and more with buildings all over the city. They organized, they got in touch with the Los Angeles Tenants Union, with the Legal Aid Foundation. Eventually, the city councilman that you heard from earlier, Gil Cedillo, got involved. And it looks like they have come to an agreement that's going to keep this building affordable for 10 more years. It's a little bit complicated, but essentially, the landlord, Thomas Botts, still owes the city about $5 million on the property. So they're essentially going to cancel that debt in exchange for keeping the building affordable for a number of years. It all still needs to be finalized. It needs to go through the city attorney. But last week, the city council approved the broad strokes of the deal. And I spoke to the landlord, Thomas Botts, who said he's on board with this, and he called it a win-win. Even though he did plan to raise the rents, he already did buy out a number of people before this deal was done, paid them to leave the building. He says that he would like the tenants to stay. He said he's known the tenants for a long time. And so it looks like in this case, they have found a solution for keeping the building affordable, at least for another decade.
And we mentioned going building by building. Is the city set up to do similar deals with other buildings like Hillside Villa?
Well, that's a good question, because at this point, every building's a little bit different. There's another property right nearby, also in Chinatown, called the Metro Lofts. It's an affordable building for senior citizens. It's a different situation there, but also under affordable covenants, and tenants, again, there we're looking at seeing big rent increases, potentially having to leave. In that case, the city councilman Gil Cedillo's office worked it out so that a developer who is building a brand new building in Chinatown, instead of putting some affordable housing in that brand new project, is going to help pay to keep the Metro Lofts affordable for the coming years. So, and that led to then criticism that this new building wasn't going to have any affordable housing in it. So things get messy really fast. Here's what Cedillo said about that particular deal.
And so our choices were very clear. We could have held out for a handful of affordable units and maybe they'll be built in 5 years, or we could today provide real solutions to real problems and protect the 123 units of housing that was across the street at Metro Lofts. We did that.
So he's saying no matter what happened, people are getting affordable housing out of this deal, no matter what.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. And, you know, he was able in these instances to work out deals where these buildings are going to remain affordable. But there's still this big question of what is the wholesale policy?
I mean, tens of thousands, as you mentioned.
Right. These tens of thousands of apartments that are going to be facing this issue. The city is working on putting together some sort of inventory of all the units with expiring covenants coming up, which is just a first step. So figuring out where they are, when they're going to expire, and then from there, they're going to work on some plan. But the city has a big job to do here.
It sounds like such a hodgepodge. And I guess I would think about the person who hears all this and asks, why should the city step in to extend these so-called covenants? I mean, they were always meant to expire. Mm-hmm. The private developers and the landlords did their part, right? They mm-hmm. like the Hillside Villa folks, they got 30 years out of it. Why does the city need to step in at all?
Yeah, so we touched on this earlier, but the city is facing this affordability crisis that maybe wasn't fully anticipated back when these deals were made. We all know that rents have gone up a lot in recent years. It hasn't been in line with incomes. So if you believe that low to middle income people who contribute to the local economy, who work in Los Angeles, should be able to live near their jobs, these buildings have been a big part of that, and there really isn't any replacement. At Hillside Villa, we heard from Renee Alexander earlier. He works at Walt Disney Concert Hall, which is just a quick walk away from this building. Another person I spoke to at the building is a tenant named Rosa Hernandez. She's a house cleaner who lives with her daughter.
I work around the area, the Arts District. I worked in Hollywood. I worked in Silver Lake. So it's just walking distance to everything and our doctors and our schools and just the community itself. It's great.
So what she's saying is we've built our lives around living in this neighborhood and want to keep living here. And if you do value living in a diverse and inclusive city, these buildings are a big part of that.
And when your rent could perhaps double, right, in a situation like this, mm-hmm. what do you do?
There's not a lot of places to go.
Not a lot of places to go. KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers the homelessness and housing beat. Anna, thank you.
Thank you.
We're online, by the way, at kcrw.com/greaterLA, and wherever you get your podcasts. You can also reach us on Facebook and Twitter at the KCRW pages by hashtagging it GreaterLA. Housing and homelessness, big issues that affect us all here in Greater LA. Another big issue is the environment, air quality, water, trash, recycling. Well, LA County is out with a new sustainability plan touching on all those issues and more, but how realistic is it? You're going to hear that coming up. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The LA County Board of Supervisors adopted a new sustainability plan this week. It is a 200-plus page document that includes a dozen big goals and lots of ambitious targets to hit, making parks and public lands more accessible, going fossil fuel free in 25 years, diverting nearly all of the county's waste from landfills, among other things in that document. Well, 10 million people live in LA County, and the economy here is bigger than more than 40 other states. So what happens here is a big deal. Sheila Kuehl is on the LA County Board of Supervisors, and she's with us right now. Supervisor, thanks for being here.
It's always a pleasure, Steve. Thanks.
You bet. So break this plan down for us. What is in it? And I guess give us sort of the nut graph, if you will.
The interesting thing about it is it's probably the most comprehensive regional approach ever issued by any county in the U.S. And, of course, we are the largest county, so that makes sense. So the plan makes us resilient. It talks about a lot of green jobs. I'll give you some of the highlights. We want to power all the unincorporated areas and the county facilities with 100% renewable energy by 2025, which is not that far away, as you know, but I think we can do it. We want to increase tree canopy coverage by 15%. We're going to divert 95% of all the waste from landfills, and we can do this. We want to develop land use tools to limit new development in the high climate hazard areas, phase out single-use plastics by 2025, cutting back on imported water by sourcing 80% of our water locally. You know, towns like Santa Monica are going to be 100% on their own wells in just a couple of years, and it makes a difference.
There are 88 cities in L.A. County, Supervisor, and you guys have limited jurisdiction, obviously, of those places. There's no enforcement mechanism, is there, that these cities would have to adopt these goals? So how do you do that?
Well, some of it is incentives, and some of it actually can be adopted countywide. You know, we negotiate with the cities, but we do have public health jurisdiction. And so, for instance, now that Measure W has been passed, we're able to do a lot more in terms of recycling the stormwater, which means a lot more clean water for the cities in all of the water districts because we can recycle to them. So there are various areas where we can put some regulations, but you're right. Land use is up to them. The use of electricity in their jurisdictions is up to them. So we tried to create some incentives as well.
I mean, is there anything else you can do, or do you think the cities are going to come along? I mean, the incentives are great, but you know, a lot of cities, number one, don't have the wherewithal to do it or the money to do it, and they may be reluctant to do it.
Well, if they say they don't have the money, that's what incentives are about. And if they're reluctant, there's not a lot we can do. But for instance, landfills are not generally under the jurisdiction of cities, so we can divert a lot more waste. We can establish our own recycling programs that they can participate in. Transit is all countywide. It's not really a city thing. So, you know, rivers, lakes, even the ocean, in terms of clean water standards, that's really up to us, not to the cities. So there's a lot that we can do. And I think this is a bold plan. It's amazing. It sets goals. It also I think exemplifies how we can get to those goals, and that's really an important thing. Let us show you how to get there. Let us show you that it's good for you.
Supervisor Sheila Kuehl from the L.A. County Board of Supervisors, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Steve. Always good to talk to you.
Well, all right, let's take a deeper dive into some of these targets. Cassie Rouser directs the Sustainable L.A. Grand Challenge over at UCLA and helped prepare this plan along with other researchers there in Westwood. Hi, Cassie. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, there was one target goal that stood out to me, Cassie. By 2045, LA County wants to source 80% of its water locally. Is that really possible? I mean, isn't LA pretty much a desert? Where would all that water come from?
Well, here's the thing. We currently do not utilize the water that we have here in the region for the most part. Right now, the county sources around 60% of its water from outside of the region. So we've never really had to rely on the water we have here in the region. And in the city, it's even higher. It's upwards of around 90% of the water comes from outside of the region. We can, of course, capture stormwater. So we do have some rain, and we can capture that water. And especially in the wetter years, we should be capturing a lot of that water, and we can utilize it, and we can store it. We also do have a lot of groundwater here. And we haven't traditionally used the groundwater in the past. A lot of it is very contaminated, but there is a lot of groundwater space. And so if we capture our stormwater and we recycle the water that we are using, which we also do not do a lot of right now, we can use that water to replenish our groundwater system. So in those drought years, if we clean up our groundwater, we really do sort of have a natural storage system here in the region that we've never utilized.
Here's something else that caught our attention, and this is going fossil fuel free by the year 2050, which sounds like it's far away. It's not that far away. What does that actually mean, Cassie? And are we talking about there would be no gas stations in LA County by 2050?
Yeah, I think that's what that means.
can you imagine, life without gasoline-fueled cars and without gas stations just in the next 30 years?
I mean, I think that's the direction that the state of California has been going. We definitely need to ramp up that effort. I think instead of gas stations, you might see different types of fueling stations. I think we're going to think about fuel in a very different way. We need to electrify transportation, electrify our vehicles. You might see charging stations in place of those gas stations, and you might see other types of fuel like hydrogen fuel, which we see a little bit throughout California as well.
Well, and think about, I mean, when we talk about gasoline and fossil fuels, we talk about people who work in that industry, oil and gas industry, and that's pretty big here in LA. You see the derricks around town and also all across Southern California that employ these workers. Like the companies are going to say, look, you know, this is our bread and butter. Why are you taking this away from us?
Absolutely. I mean, we saw that with the release of the Mayor's Green New Deal this year. I think it's difficult because I think change is difficult. And the thing we need to remember is there are going to be a number of new jobs created in the new green economy. There are already a number of new jobs created in this space. And so it's not going to be for lack of jobs. It's going to have to be a partnership and a collaboration to make sure that the right training and workforce development happens for people in those existing spaces.
I know another target in the plan is to have no loss of native biodiversity, which is interesting to me. We're talking about specific habitats in LA County that you find very important to protect. Explain that.
This is one of my favorites, near and dear to my heart. LA County, as you know, is very diverse in the types of habitat and landscape that we have. In fact, we have about 65% of the land in LA County is considered natural areas. And that seems kind of crazy when you think of LA, because I think a lot of people think of the concrete jungle, but we do have a lot of and diverse natural habitats around here. So the plan is committing to increasing the amount of those natural areas that is protected. And it's also committing to protecting the critical habitats for the plants and animals that exist here, which is also really important because LA County does fall within one of the world's biodiversity hotspots.
Cassie Rouser directs the Sustainable LA Grand Challenge over at UCLA, which takes the research there from the university and connects it to what's happening in the region. Cassie, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Coming up next, he has a unique style. Alma Allen carves nameless biomorphic sculptures. He designs furniture, things that resemble furniture, but take on lives of their own. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Alma Allen is the type of artist where you need to look through his entire body of work to see the whole picture. It's his life and experiences that shape every one of his pieces, from where he grew up to how he got discovered to his process. He has a unique style. He carves nameless biomorphic sculptures. And Allen's new work is on display at Blum & Poe in Los Angeles through August 17th. And Lindsay Preston-Zappas is here to talk about it, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Steve.
I want to talk more about Allen's work in general. His work is pretty recognizable. What does an Alma Allen piece look like?
Yeah, so you described it really well as biomorphic abstraction.
Well, explain what that is, biomorphic extraction.
Right. So it's, you know, his pieces aren't meant to look like anything. He's not carving a person or a tree. You know, they're meant to be abstract. So they don't have any recognizable form to them, although they evoke a lot of things. They could be natural objects in nature or waveforms. They also suggest utilitarian forms like tables and chairs, and they sort of have like a dual purpose to them in that way. But they really have their own character. They might be in wood, bronze, or stone, and they're very singular in their look, like very simple gestures that he's carving out of these materials. Alma says that as a kid, he grew up in Utah, and he would go into these caves and just carve stone and wood. And, you know, as a kid, you can imagine tinkering with little wood and stone, and that, he says his work hasn't changed all that much since then. Like, he still follows that intuition in his making and kind of following his own hand to create the piece.
His backstory is really fascinating. How was he discovered? How did someone see what he was doing and be like, wow, this guy's pretty good?
Yeah. So he grew up in a big Mormon family in Utah. He's one of 11 or so children. And he didn't finish high school. And at the age of 16, he sort of fled and charted his own pathway. And I think that in and of itself is really unique for a contemporary artist, that he didn't go to school. He didn't go to art school. So he doesn't have that kind of over specialization and training. So anyway, he's young, early 20s. He makes his way to New York City, and he ended up getting a really bad bicycle accident where he got hit by a New York bus, actually.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and really intense medical bills. And so kind of out of desperation, he ended up dragging an ironing board out onto the streets of New York and started to sell his little sculptures off an ironing board.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, so he was just like, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to figure out what to do.
So he had mounting medical bills.
Yeah.
And he's fresh from getting in an accident with a bus on a bike.
Maybe on crutches. I don't know.
And he drags an ironing board to a street in New York and is like, look, I'm going to sell this stuff.
Yeah, and he's selling them for $20, $40. But he happened to set up this ironing board in front of a restaurant that a lot of Soho gallerists would frequent. So they started seeing him and taking an interest and buying little pieces for, again, like $20. And then it just so happened that there were also design studios in the area. So there were designers that kind of gave him his first opportunities. He ended up moving to L.A. and he opened up a pop-up studio store with his girlfriend at the time, which was sort of an expanded version of this ironing board. So he would have his little sculptures on top of shelves and furniture that he built himself. So that's sort of where designers saw his work for the first time and took an interest and sort of prodded him into the design world a bit.
His process has changed over the years as well, like how the things that he's made and how he's made those things. I mean, forget about the ironing board and displaying it.
Yeah.
Like, the things that he put on those shelves have changed.
Definitely. So, you know, wood carving, stone carving, these are very taxing things for the body and the shoulders and the back and his hands. So he ended up getting carpal tunnel in his hands just from he started as a kid. So his whole life he's been carving stone. So in the early 2000s, he ended up having a lot of medical problems and carpal tunnel with his hands. And he had a couple surgeries, but still, even today, he can only carve for about an hour or two at a time. So his solution, classic style, is he just found this robot. So it's a huge robotic arm that he trained on and works with a software now where he can scan his smaller sculptures into the computer. And this robot actually finishes the pieces for him. And, you know, you think of robot as clean lines, but it's really amazing that he's able to get these bulbous organic shapes with a robotic arm. I will mention that he works with a lot of assistants who have to then sand and finish everything. So it's not just the robot.
You saw this exhibit. What'd you think?
I think it's beautiful. I mean, I think in the art world today, we're used to being kind of hit over the head with concept and idea and those things kind of driving the work. But with Alma, as I said, it's so about the material and the gesture. And so you walk in and it feels very peaceful. It's kind of about the relationship between the works and the materiality. So it's kind of like a simpler way of working that's a bit more of like a 20th century modernist approach, but it feels kind of brave and radical to be doing that today.
Well, it goes through a week from Sunday, August 17th, over at Blum & Poe in Los Angeles. Lindsay Preston-Zappas from Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, Gustavo Arellano on the El Paso to L.A. pipeline from decades ago. Next up on KCRW, all the president's lawyers. We're online, kcrw.com/greaterLA, and where you get your podcasts. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ear and for the time. Have a great day.